There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, a very neglected form of truly independent media. I'm talking about home movies. And August 12th is National Home Movie Day. We'll hear from Jimmy Jones, who's coordinating Home Movie Day here in Champaign, Urbana. And we'll discuss why home movies are important and why they need to be preserved. And, of course, we're going to catch up with what's going on in your media environment with some Media Geek News. Stay tuned, will you? When you hear about a group called Hands Off the Internet, or TV for Us, you'd think they're grassroots organizations working to preserve internet freedom and preserve free TV. And you'd certainly think that a group called the Video Access Alliance would be all about saving public access TV. At least, that's what they'd want you to think. But the truth is, they're not grassroots so much as they're AstroTurf, funded by millions coming from the telecommunications industry. Senator Lloyd Benson is credited with coining the term AstroTurf in the 1980s to describe corporations' big money efforts to put fake grassroots pressure on Congress. AstroTurf campaigns claim to represent large coalitions of concerned citizens, but in reality their public support is minimal or non-existent. A new report by the nonpartisan watchdogs at Common Cause compiles dossiers on five of these AstroTurfers working the communications beat, revealing their connections to telephone and cable companies and PR firms. All of these groups purport to be part of a huge public groundswell of support for a national cable TV franchise in opposition to network neutrality, but in reality, the only public participation in these groups are the dollars from our telephone, internet, and cable TV bills that are funneled to lobbyists, internet sites, and advertising. Take, for instance, the group called Hands Off the Internet. Its website says, quote, Hands Off the Internet is a nationwide coalition of internet users united together in the belief that the net's phenomenal growth over the past decade stems from the ability of entrepreneurs to expand consumer choices and opportunities without worrying about government regulation, end quote. As part of their advocacy efforts, Hands Off the Internet has been lobbying and advertising aggressively against network neutrality, falsely painting it as a way for large internet companies like Google to get free bandwidth on the backs of internet service subscribers. But take a look at the group's list of member organizations, and you won't see anything that looks remotely grassroots. Instead, you'll see companies like AT&T and Singular, and industry groups like the National Association of Manufacturers. Unlike real grassroots groups, you won't see any petitions or lists of regular people who've signed on in support. In fact, Common Cause says, quote, if there were an award for AstroTurf lobby campaigns, Hands Off the Internet would win hands down, end quote. While Hands Off the Internet never reveals the contributions of its sponsors, Common Cause guesses that it must be up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, since in a single month, the group spent $693,658 on television advertising alone. The Video Access Alliance is another misleadingly named AstroTurf group that got outed by Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts during a congressional hearing. Video Access Alliance Chairman Julia Johnson offered testimony in support of national franchising to the Congress and in opposition to any provisions that would require telephone companies to build out their services to poor, rural, or minority neighborhoods. Representative Markey then questioned her motivations, asking if the Video Access Alliance is supported by any telephone companies. After initially claiming the group received no support, Johnson was forced to admit that she herself owns a consulting group, Net Communications, that is paid princely sums by the Bell telephone companies. In fact, Johnson's firm and the Video Access Alliance even share an office. You have to wonder who's paying the rent. So the next time you see an ad urging Congress to keep their hands off the internet or claiming that your internet bill will go up if internet freedom is made into law, consider not just the source, but who's paying for it. The Common Cause Report is all the goods on these AstroTurf groups and can be found at the Media Geek website, MediaGeek.net, and at CommonCause.org. And all this year on Media Geek, I've been covering proposed changes to telecommunications law and policy that have been roughly lumped together as the Telecom Act of 2006. But we're still feeling the effects of the last major revision of our telecommunications and media environment that happened with the Telecommunications Act of 1996. One of the biggest changes to our media landscape happened with the Act's massive loosening of radio ownership regulations. The 1996 Act did away with the national cap on radio station ownership and greatly increased the number of stations a single company can own in one market. Those changes precipitated the creation of radio giants like Clear Channel Communications, which owns 1,200 stations nationwide and virtually controls many radio markets across the country. While we've seen the effects of this consolidation on the programs we hear, with nationalized playlists programmed thousands of miles away, and an increase in the number of ads per hour, and a loss of localism in radio, there has also been a major impact on jobs in radio. A new study released by the Future of Music Coalition found that the vast majority of major U.S. cities has experienced both layoffs and lower wage growth within the radio profession. Jenny Toomey, musician and executive director of the Future of Music Coalition, said that radio industry consolidation has, quote, devastated the broadcast profession and virtually eliminated the ability of radio stations to provide unique coverage of local news, music, and community issues. Before the FCC's moves forward to further loosen already weak ownership limits, it should understand the impact that deregulation has had on jobs and communities, end quote. Some of the study's findings include that the combined market share of the top four radio companies in each local market increased by an average of 14.3% from 1993 to 2004 across 265 different markets. Cities with higher degrees of radio consolidation had greater job losses among news reporters and broadcast technicians from 1996 to 2003. And cities with higher degrees of radio consolidation experienced smaller wage growth for DJs and news reporters from 1996 to 2003. According to the study, the ability to own as many as 8 stations in a single radio market has allowed companies to exploit an economy of scale through such practices as voice tracking, which uses pre-recorded voice breaks to replace live local DJs. Companies have cut costs by centralizing operations and reducing the number of programmers, reporters, and engineers. Consolidation has hurt localism through the use of more nationally syndicated music programming and a reduced ability of stations to conduct emergency broadcast warnings. The study was conducted by the Future of Music Coalition Research Director, Peter DeCola, and relies on data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics Occupational Employment Survey to measure employment in each of 3 radio professions, including DJs, news reporters, and broadcast technicians, across 246 cities over the years 1996 through 2003. You can read that report at futureofmusic.org. And way back in September of 2002, I talked to a radio engineer who found himself put out of job when his radio station was bought up by Clear Channel, and he told me all about it. You can go to radio.mediageek.net and click on the September 2002 link on the right-hand side of the page to listen to that interview to find out how a whole pile of radio stations were basically warehoused in one building and people lost their jobs. And you are listening to Media Geek. Go online to MediaGeek.net for the Media Geek blog to get references of many of the things I speak about here on the program and to get news and views on our media environment that I just don't have time for in this half-hour radio program. If you have any comments about the program, send them to me, paul@MediaGeek.net. So August 12th is Home Movie Day across the country. where people will be gathering in cities all over the place to watch home movies and to learn why they're important and how we can preserve these great artifacts of 20th century culture. Locally here in Champaign-Urbana, Home Movie Day will be celebrated at public radio station and TV station WILL in Urbana on the University of Illinois campus. Jimmy Jones is a student in library and information science, himself a filmmaker and home movie enthusiast. He's one of the organizers behind the local Home Movie Day here in Urbana. And he tells me more about why home movies are important and what this day is all about.
Home Movie Day is taking place this Saturday from 1 to 5 at WILL in Urbana. The idea behind Home Movie Day is, I think it's actually twofold. One is it's a chance for community members to come together and share their home movies with each other and share their history and their families and so forth. And then the other reason for Home Movie Day is it's kind of an outreach tool. The point of it is to explain to people how film is important, not just as a capture medium, but the film itself is a good preservation medium. In fact, it's the best preservation medium that we have, better than even digital media. So it's important for people to keep their home movies, not just transfer them to video or DVD and throw them away. So it's not only a chance for the community to come together and view movies, but it's also a chance to learn about the importance of film.
Well, so first, I mean, I guess the question is, why would a home movie be important to begin with?
Home movies are important to a lot of people. Obviously, they're important to the people that shot it and the families that are invested in it. But it's also important to documentarians, researchers, filmmakers of all kinds like to use home movies, not just as background, you know, as a, like B-roll, secondary footage, but also to get an idea of the sense of a place. For example, if you want to see how Urbana looked in 1948, the best place to look would be a home movie. Someone who actually lived there and was driving a car of the time, you know, wearing the clothes of the time, and you can see the downtown, the streets, the billboards and so forth, even better than you could in a picture out of a magazine or a description in a book. Home movies are very intimate, so they show you how places really looked at the time and how they felt.
So would you say it's something which, at the time it's shot, or even as it's being watched in its contemporary time, is sort of thought as ephemeral, but might have value to later generations?
Yeah, I think so. The immediacy of the home movie, I think, is the paramount issue. It's that, you know, when you see these films, you're not seeing actors. There's no distance between you and the subject, such as you would get like in a Hollywood film, or something that's very glamorous or glitzy or very, very polished with high production values. You're actually seeing a camera that was recording whatever was happening, a parade, a national monument visit, a vacation, something like that. So I think it's the immediacy that has value to future generations.
And you said the other half is to get people to think about preserving film, because film is the best medium to preserve these things. And I think that's sort of not what most people think, now that we're all into high definition and DVDs and Blu-ray.
Indeed. Yeah, it's counterintuitive, you know, because film projectors, especially Super 8 projectors, are cranky, they're hard to find. Film can be very easily damaged by projection if it's not done properly. But at the same time, when you think about film, all you need to see what's on a piece of film is light. Just hold up a piece of film to light, and you can see what's on it. Contrast that to a DVD or a videotape. If you don't have a functioning DVD player, if you don't have a functioning VHS player, you won't be able to tell what's on the tape. Like, imagine if you had a Betamax tape from 1979 or something. You would have a really hard time finding out what was on it, being able to view it. With film, at least you can see what's on it. Even if you can't play it back, you have an idea of what the image is on it. So that's one of the reasons why film is such an important preservation medium. And I think also because digital technology is changing so quickly. I shot my undergraduate films about 6 years ago on DV8 tape. And now I'll be darned if I can find any place that even has a DV8 player. So, but film is film. No one owns a patent of film. No one owns the carrier medium or the chemistry of film. So it's universal, and it's easier to find people who can tell you what's on your film than it is to find you know, someone who can tell you what's on your old Betamax tape or your 2-inch videotape or something like that.
So if I bring in a film that's been in storage since the 1950s or 40s to your home movie day, is it likely someone's going to be able to tell me how I might watch it?
Yeah, exactly. That's another thing that we're doing as part of the outreach is we're going to have people like myself and some other archivists and librarians who are going to take a look at your film and make sure, first of all, that it can be projected because film shrinks, breaks down, the sprocket holes could get torn up. There are any number of things that could make your film susceptible to damage from projection. So we want to kind of weed those out. And we can also tell you a little bit about how to store your film, give you an idea of why your film looks the way that it does, what's making it curl like that, what's making it shrink, how you should store it, and what you can do with it to make it last as long as possible.
So if I have a film that looks sort of damaged and I bring it in, and you decide, well, that's not something you should put through your 8mm projector. I mean, are there things that I can do to still preserve the images that are on there?
There are. You know, usually decay can be slowed, and there are actually laboratories that specialize in different kinds of techniques to get the image off of film. So it might be making another print from your film. It might be using chemicals to clean it. It could be using chemicals to kind of flatten it out a little bit if it's curled and those kinds of things. They come at a premium, but it's usually worth it to a lot of people, especially if there's just no way to project it. So all hope is not lost if your film looks bad. There's usually a way to get some kind of image off of it, so it's worth bringing it in and having us take a look at it.
So when you say make a copy, you mean make a copy onto another print to make another film of it?
Make another print. There are also labs that can telecine, which means to make a video, a high-quality video duplicate. Usually you can specify what you want.
And if I make a video duplicate, then I'm done? I don't have to worry about it ever again? Can I just toss out the old film?
No, of course not. You don't ever want to throw your film away. Like I said before, the film is the preferred medium to this day for image capture in terms of archival storage. So you don't want to ever throw it away. That film will be there much longer than your DVD will. It'll be there much longer than your VHS tape will, your mini DV tape, or your digital video stream. Those things are great. Those things are wonderful ways to share your films with people, you know, the DVDs and so forth. But they will never replace film in terms of how long they last and how universal they are.
Well, if film is so good, then why is it we're seeing this huge push towards video, towards digital video, George Lucas using, you know, high-definition video to shoot Star Wars movies now?
Cost. One of the big costs that film studios just hate to have to put out is the cost of shipping film. Film is very heavy. 35mm canisters of film are extremely heavy, and the shipping is a nightmare. A lot of times films are finished just days before their release, and so getting them shipped in just a couple of days to thousands of screens costs the theaters a lot of money, or actually costs the production companies a lot of money. So they balk at that kind of expenditure. And I think also digital videos allowed more people to afford to kind of buy into the process. Like, for myself, I can't possibly afford to shoot a 35mm film, but I can shoot a digital video film that'll look pretty good. So there's that. I think it's just a matter of cost, unfortunately.
But isn't a lot of digital video, especially high-definition video, isn't it better looking? Don't you get better quality now than you would, especially with an 8mm, a little tiny film?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you do. I mean, there's all kinds of arguments for, you know, how beautiful film looks, and you can go back and forth on that, but digital video and high-definition video is amazing. It's an amazing capture medium. The only problem is we don't know how to store it. We don't know how long it's going to last. And a lot of the compression algorithms and so forth are owned by companies that who knows if they'll be around and who knows if they'll want to share them in 50 years, whereas film, you know, no one owns the patent to film, so there you go.
Well, millions of people right now are taking their digital video camcorders, whether it records to tape or records to DVD and now hard disk, mm-hmm. and they're capturing memories. Are you saying that it may be in 50 years we won't be able to recapture as much of that as we are able to do now with celluloid?
It's hard to predict, but that could happen. One of the problems and one of the expenditures that audiovisual archives have to put out is not just maintaining the media, but also maintaining the players. For example, if you have a stack of DVDs, but you don't have a properly functioning DVD player, then your stack of DVDs is almost worthless. So it becomes a lot more expensive for archives to maintain all these different kind of disparate forms of video. So it could be that in 50 years it's going to be hard to find something, you know, to play your old, I don't know what, you know, 8mm video home movie. But there will probably be houses that keep these kinds of machines, you know, in good working order, but it'll be hard to find, is my prediction. And potentially expensive.
And so if I've got a shoebox full of old 8mm home movies mm-hmm. that my father or grandfather or grandmother shot, and I want to make sure that I keep them and store them as best I can, what are some basic tips for doing that?
Basic tips are to keep them dry, keep them cool. You don't have to freeze them, but you want to keep them at room temperature or below. You don't want to expose them to moisture. You don't want to expose them to too much air. You want to make sure they're not smelling like vinegar. Older films tend to break down in such a way as they actually produce a kind of acid that smells just like vinegar. I think it's chemically similar to vinegar, in fact. So you want to make sure that everything is aerated but not getting too moist.
Are there boxes that you can buy? Is there any sort of materials you can buy that would help you do that that's not too expensive?
There are. They tend to be kind of pricey. You can buy different kinds of inert film cans and film boxes. There are a couple different companies that produce them. Trying to think of some of the names. I think I'll, they escape me at the moment, but I'll have a handout when you come to Home Movie Day of answers to questions like that. You know, where can I put my films and what can I keep them in and so forth. So.
And Home Movie Day is not just happening in Urbana.
No, it's not. It's happening all over the country. In fact, it's happening all over the world. I think there are a number of them in Japan, and there's some in the UK. I think there are a few in Canada, and I believe Austria. If you go to homemovieday.com, they have a list of all the different events around the world.
Are there preservation tips there, too?
There are. There are preservation tips. There are. There's a wonderful list of different places all over the country that will print your films for you if you have unprocessed film, and archives that you can donate to if you don't want to keep your films for whatever reason, and places where you can get your films duplicated onto video. So it's a wonderful resource.
And how did you get interested in Home Movie Day and bringing it? This is the first time it's been in Urbana, right?
It's the first time, yeah. I was part of Home Movie Day in Salt Lake City 2 years ago. I was working as a film archivist. I did my undergraduate work in film production and then became an archivist there in Salt Lake. And we did it in 2004, and it was really great. We had a wonderful turnout. And a few months ago, a lady from the library who works in the conservation unit, Annette Morris, sent me an email. She had been to a conference about film preservation, and some of the people there that were giving the workshop mentioned Home Movie Day, and my name somehow came to Annette, and she gave me an email, I think back in April or May, and we've just been kind of hatching this thing up ever since then, so we're pretty excited about it.
And why are you particularly excited? Why are you willing to put in all this time?
Well, I think that it's important. I think film is important. It's what I dedicated my life to, both making it and preserving it. I love that there are films all over the country just sitting in people's attics that can be brought to light. You know, we can see some of the images on them. People can learn how to preserve them. Some of the things we've been talking about in the last few minutes, you know, with digital video kind of supplanting film, while it has a lot of benefits, it also has a lot of drawbacks in terms of people not realizing that their films still have value. So I'm very committed to preservation of these films. I'm committed to having people see each other's films. It's a wonderful tool for the community to come together and have a good day, just kicking back and watching movies and eating popcorn, you know, and to see themselves on the big screen. I mean, people really get a kick out of it, and I love seeing that. So I think that's a lot of it.
Jimmy, thank you very much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
And that is Jimmy Jones, an organizer behind Home Movie Day happening in Urbana on Saturday, August 12th, 1 to 5 p.m. at the studios of WILL TV and Radio in Campbell Hall, 300 North Goodwin in Urbana. And Home Movie Day is actually happening all over the country on August 12th. Find out more, learn more about your home movies at homemovieday.com. And one last announcement here. Michael Leahy's documentary, Making Waves, is an unflinching look at the politics and personalities behind the pirate radio scene that happened in Tucson, Arizona. If you haven't had a chance to see Making Waves, the film will be making an appearance at the Chicago Underground Film Festival at 1 p.m. on August 19th and 6 p.m. on August 21st. Both showings will be at the Music Box Theater, 3733 North Southport Avenue in Chicago. The festival's website is cuffcuff.org. Making Waves has also been showing every month on Free Speech TV, which is free to all Dish Network subscribers, and also airs on many public access TV stations nationwide. The next showing of Making Waves will be on August 24th. You can also check out a new trailer for the film at its website, jumpcutfilms.com/makingwaves. And I interviewed filmmaker Michael Leahy on the November 12th, 2004 edition of the radio show. You can listen to that archive online at radio.mediageek.net. Then go down the right-hand column and look for November 2004. Click there, and you'll be able to listen to it going back in time with the Media Geek radio show. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at mediageek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton-Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.